A smart person learns from their mistakes. A wise person learns from others' mistakes. Welcome to the My Mistakes Podcast. We cover the lessons learned from the mistakes we've made in business so you won't do the same. I'm Chris Gianciulli. Today's guest is Evan Samet. He started his first business at 19 years old and sold it when he was 25. We'll find out how him being in the live event and ticket space was affected by COVID-19 and what he's done to pivot and prepare for when things reopen. This episode is being brought to you by Don Pablo Coffee. Specialty grade beans roasted in small batches. It's a better cup of coffee. Get yours at Amazon or at DonPabloCoffee.com. So on today's episode of the My Mistakes Podcast, I'm going to be doing an interview with someone whose business was affected with all that we have going on right now. But instead of quitting and crying about being a victim, this person has found new innovative ways to take his business to a place that it might not have gone to if not for a global pandemic. So today's guest is Evan Samet. Evan, if you could introduce yourself and let everyone know what you do and kind of just give us an overview and then we'll break it down from there.
Hey, well, first, thanks for having me on the podcast, Chris. My name is Evan Samet. I'm 27 years old. I live right outside of Washington, D.C. in Arlington, Virginia. And I am in the live ticketing entertainment space, which means I sell tickets, VIP experiences, meet and greets to concerts, sporting events, Broadway shows, and comedy shows throughout the country. I started a business in this space when I was 19 years old. I grew that business and sold that business at 25 years old, and then partnered with a company who, you know, kind of was looking to grow in the space and become a very large player. And you know, grew that business from, I was the fifth employee to having 32 to 33 employees. And then, you know, in March of 2020, due to, you know, COVID-19, our business took a complete downfall that, you know, none of us could ever have seen coming.
So ticket sales, what age were you when you got into this area? You said starting a business at 19. Were you into concerts or live events prior to that? What was it that was your motivation?
So I had always loved to go to concerts and sporting events, you know, in high school, at the beginning of college. And I don't know why I was, you know, I studied entrepreneurial, small business management and finance. When I was in school, and I was, you know, I was really wanting to take a risk and, you know, had the inkling to start a business. Again, I had started a business when I was 15, selling tennis, you know, giving tennis lessons, and I had the itch to start something. And I started realizing that music, which was my primary focus, had to be seen live. You know, the days of buying albums were coming to an end. You know, people were buying individual songs on iTunes, but it wasn't, you know, what it used to be back in the 80s or 90s, where you could sell, you know, 10, 20, 25 million albums. So I decided to, you know, kind of empty out my savings account. And, you know, this house music group, Swedish House Mafia, was, you know, playing their last four shows ever in New York at Madison Square Garden in the Barclays Center. And I thought that was going to be, you know, the biggest thing. I knew everyone at school was talking about it. So I decided to empty out my savings and buy up, you know, just like any other fan would, $6,000 worth of tickets for it.
I don't think that's what every fan would do. You definitely were unique in doing that. So I guess what I'm thinking is, like, that wouldn't occur to me to buy tickets and mark them up and that model. What was it that gave you that inkling or that idea? Did someone suggest it to you, or was this something that just you saw an opportunity to where you could make some money? I don't want to say without effort, but without effort.
So it was funny. So I guess technically the first tickets I ever really, really sold were to go to this show is called a Barstool Blackout, and from, you know, who does Barstool Sports, from Dave Portnoy. And they were playing, you know, at a little club near us where we went to school in New Haven. And I bought the tickets for my group of friends, and I bought them for $10 each, and they were sold out. And someone, you know, offered me $20 for it. I go, wow, I just made 10 bucks. You know, I had 8 tickets for my friends and my roommates, and none of us could go. And I was able to make $80. And I said, wow, this was, you know, as you said before, kind of effortless. And I would go, wow, like, if someone's willing to, you know, pay, a, you know, markups for Barstool Blackout, there must be a markup for, you know, bands that actually are going to go play stadiums or play arenas. And I had gone to see a lot of concerts and ball games at the Prudential Center, at Madison Square Garden. And, you know, I've been a New York Giants football fan. So I knew growing up how, you know, when the Giants were good, when there was demand to get Giant tickets. So I said, well, I knew there was a demand. I knew now from this that, you know, there was able to make a markup. So when I realized at the time when there wasn't, you know, that big of a barrier to entry for it, I was able to, you know, say, okay, let me put together, you know, not even a real formal plan, but figure out what I want to do and then just start, you know, selling tickets for it. And, you know, with the Swedish House Mafia show, it ended up being a big hit for me. And I just went slowly but surely. I just kept buying a little bit, selling a little bit, buying a little bit, and never took $1 of outside capital.
When you're doing that and you're growing, are you starting to form, let's say, a customer or client list to where you go to them first once you have a bunch of tickets? Or what was your way of getting the word out and finding people to buy for you?
So when I first started, I tried to buy as many tickets as I can in the Northeast, because I knew that I knew people there. I had family friends. I had friends from college who, you know, at least I had connections. So I reached out, and a lot of my early business was through family friends or friends of family. And then, you know, I kind of, as I was growing a little bit, I became, you know, it became a little more difficult to actually make these connections and sell tickets to my family friends, because they were looking for a certain price. And, you know, it felt weird kind of upselling, you know, people that you knew. So at the time, you know, StubHub and Vivid Seats and Ticket Network and all these, you know, ticket selling websites were really taking off and putting a lot of money into advertising and customer bases. And I was able to post my tickets on those websites and have them sell. And I found that while I did have to pay a fee or commission to them, it allowed me to be able to say, okay, well, if I think a popular artist is coming to Minnesota, I can buy and sell tickets in Minnesota, because these websites are open in, obviously, in Minnesota, and have people in Minnesota who would check there. I, for example, didn't know anyone who lived in Minnesota. So being able to sell on, you know, these websites and kind of give up personal clientele allowed me to expand the business to where, instead of just buying and selling in New Jersey, New York, Massachusetts, and Connecticut, where I knew people, I could then expand to sell in any state in the country.
So it's interesting. So I would have guessed that you're selling a venue or have like a stronghold on a venue. It sounds more like it's the artist themselves. Where have you ever like followed an artist on tour where you're buying blocks of tickets for multiple shows along their tour for, let's say, a period of time?
Yeah. So that's kind of where I started, where I tried to say, okay, let me pick a certain artist that I think is popular and that is going to get more popular. Because one thing I realized is, you know, everyone in the business was saying, okay, well, you just have to buy, you know, the biggest person or the biggest artist. But that's not always necessarily the case, because that's what everyone's thinking. you know, I had to say, let me get creative like I did with Swedish House Mafia, who at the time wasn't that big. And I was able to buy them, you know, for every venue. And if you think of today in sports, you know, I know, you know, if you're located in New York, you know, if you want to go see a game at the Garden or you want to go see an NBA game, people are going to see where LeBron James is playing, where Kevin Durant is playing, where James Harden is playing. So no matter where, you know, LeBron James is playing, that's always the hottest ticket. It's not the venue, it's the performer. And that's the one thing I realized early on about the business.
What performers have you had the most success selling tickets for their concerts?
So it's funny, every year it's changed. You know, initially, early on, it was, I would say, Taylor Swift. She was always she was just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But then, believe it or not, she's also been my worst tour. And I learned that the hard way where, you know, one mistake I made early on was I was just buying Taylor Swift. So Taylor Swift goes on this tour called the 1989 Tour, and it's the biggest tour ever. And she then announces her next tour, the Reputation Stadium Tour. And I'm thinking, okay, well, the 1989 tour was so successful. Let me just buy the Reputation Tour. And, you know, one thing that, again, looking back and a mistake now, she ended up raising her prices around 30% for that tour. And I'm going, well, it doesn't make a difference because I was able to upcharge 50 or 60% for it. You know, what's the difference? You know, I'll buy anything for it. And she comes out with this album, Reputation, and it doesn't chart well at all. She doesn't have the lead singles. If you even look at the YouTube statistics or the Spotify statistics, you know, the streams were down around 30 to 40% off her top album. And I just looked at it and go, oh, it doesn't make a difference, doesn't make a difference, doesn't make a difference. And, you know, the get-ins for those shows, you know, just ended up tanking. And it was actually, you know, the best tour, the 1989, and the worst tour was Reputation. And I've run into those issues also with Beyonce constantly, where she keeps raising her prices and then she'll sometimes partner up with Jay-Z. And, you know, not to knock on Jay-Z, he just doesn't have the worldwide appeal that Beyonce does. And so, you know, they double their prices because you're getting two for the price of one, but Jay-Z's price isn't the, you know, same as Beyonce's price. And, you know, these are just lessons that I've learned the hard way that, you know, my most successful tours that I've made money on have also been their next tour for the most part has been my least successful. So I would say those two.
That's got to be a challenge where it's almost like fashion. Like you can't forecast the next season only because, again, like you just said, you don't know how their album's going to do or how people are going to feel about them at a certain point. Where do you go for when you're trying to obtain analytics? Like you just mentioned Spotify. Do you go and look at how they're streaming and kind of play the markets with music and teams?
We go through a lot of, you know, different searches. And, you know, the first thing I do is I check where each single is charted in every single town in America. Because, you know, just because, you know, they have the top Billboard 100, you know, you have to look at, well, if mostly these songs are streaming from New York markets, but it's so popular in New York or California, it might not have the same appeal in Texas, in Middle America, in the Midwest. So I'm looking at streams and views and Google searches throughout every single state in the country, because there might be an artist who, you know, is only popular in a couple states, but, you know, not popular nationwide. And I'll know when they go on a tour to only focus on those states. And then, you know, there are other artists who, you know, they're just kind of popular, you know, wherever they are. So then you can kind of focus, well, you know, in New York and California and Texas, they usually have higher ticket prices than in other smaller markets. Then I could say, you know what, I can focus right now on smaller markets because I know they're going to sell, you know, like gangbusters wherever they are. and let me buy more tickets because they aren't as expensive.
When that company bought your business, what exactly were they buying? Do you have like an active customer list that they wanted those contacts to? Like, if you're just buying the ticket and marking it up, what was the value that they wanted to have?
So the one thing I was able to do when I got bigger was I was able to sign contracts with teams and, you know, artists and even work with some venues that say, okay, I have a certain amount or a certain block of tickets for whatever comes through, you know, whenever a performer comes through this town or whenever something goes on sale, because I've always been a client of yours, I have, you know, 50 to 100 tickets. When with sporting teams, I was able to sign contracts with the teams, kind of saying, I'll look and buy tickets for your teams when they're not good, but I'm going to sign a 2 to 5 year contract that says I'm able to buy these tickets every single season when the team comes and just bank on them getting better. So I was able to sell my contracts that then I put in the name, in their name. I was able to sell my sales history. So I kept a written report and a written Excel sheet that is longer than you could even imagine of every single sale that I've ever taken. And the benefit of that is when a band comes to town, you know, the people that are buying their tickets, if someone buys tickets at the last minute, that's their MO and they're always going to do that. So for example, if Justin Bieber comes to town and his, you know, hardcore fans decide, you know what, I like to buy tickets the very, very last week before the show, I had all the sales data of who was buying tickets, where, the price I bought it for, the price I sold it for, and that information is not available online because larger websites don't want you to have that information because they only make money once you start selling the tickets.
Getting away from really just the business and your approach or looking at the business or someone wanting to acquire, I'm guessing that you are a little bit different than friends of yours or people that you were seeing on a daily basis, either in college or back home. What was their feeling about you going down this road and getting into this business? And is it something that they then got bothered if they were getting charged or you were marking up tickets for them? Or did everyone expect a free handout? Speak to that point.
So, you know, it's funny. That's actually a really great question, and I can elaborate. So, you know, the first thing is, you know, when people start to realize that I'm in the business, I get text messages from people I haven't heard from in 2 years, you know, saying, hey, Evan, you know, good to hear from you. How's everything going? Oh, by the way, you know, do you have tickets to this show? So, you know, I hear from people I don't, you know, necessarily hear from all the time. But it was interesting because I would go, you know, back to my parents' house during, you know, my breaks in school. And I would go, you know, see friends and they go, oh, like you're really, you know, serious about this ticket thing. And I go, yeah. And I always tried to keep everything like kind of, you know, I don't want to say hush hush, but I'm not one to really like to brag about myself or, you know, kind of put myself up on a pedestal. So, you know, I'd say, yeah. And they go, like, are you sure that, you know, this ticket thing is going to work out? Like it's, you're just selling tickets. And I said, yeah, I completely understand. And then, you know, family, friend would be like, well, wait, you're not going to like go get an actual job? And I go, no, this is my job. This is my business that I started. And they go, you know, yeah, it's like kind of fun, but, you know, are you really going to be that guy, you know, standing outside, you know, we would always say from New York, like standing outside Yankee Stadium. I go, no.
Scalping.
Scalping, exactly. Yeah. Like the guy who's standing two blocks away saying, you got two, I need two, who needs two? And unfortunately, with the ticket business has gotten such a negative, you know, name around it because everyone thinks of, you know, the fake ticket you bought on eBay or, you know, the one time you feel like you got ripped off by the guy standing outside the stadium or, you know, everyone, it's a friend of a friend of a friend who, you know, they went to go buy a ticket and the ticket didn't work. And, you know, since then, you know, the whole business, you know, is kind of, you know, taken a hit. So unfortunately, I felt like no one ever really took me seriously in my surrounding circle. And to be honest, the one thing that makes me strive to do better is doubt. I hate to be doubted. I love to have a chip on my shoulder and everyone telling me that, you know, why am I not getting a job, or thinking this was part-time, or thinking I had a really fun college hobby. I use that to say, you know what, I'm going to show everyone and I'm just going to be better.
I love that. When I was graduating college, I think I just got into grad school, and I opened my first gym when I was 22 years old and signed my first lease and everything that goes into starting a business. And I remember one of my mom's friends at a picnic they were having said, now that you're done with college, what are you going to do for a job? And I said, oh, I have a clientele I've been working with for the last couple of years while in school. She's like, no, that's nice and all, but what are you going to do like for a job, like to make money? And I remember being so pissed off. And my response was, and this is kind of a rational response, I said, no, actually, they pay me money. And actually, they pay me a lot of money, which wasn't fully true. I was just wanting to push back. So I can definitely understand. And I love the expression, you can't eat if you're not hungry. By people doubting, that's, I think, fuel to the fire to make you succeed and go that much harder. So you find something that you're good at, you find a way to find kind of like a formula for how to make this work, and you find your style. How could you have scaled it differently? Like, why did you find an exit strategy so young to then continue to do what you're still doing now? And was it something that you could have taken bigger on your own, or was this the best option for the moment at that time?
You know, so the first mistake that I made in the business was when I had my initial success, I started kind of taking everything for granted. And then, you know, I fixed that error quickly, but the longest lasting error that I made in the business was I never let anyone in. I was very secretive. I never let anyone give me advice. I would go to conferences, entertainment ticketing conferences, and not share my story. I would just listen to everyone else and not get good advice from people who had been in the industry for, frankly, longer than I had been alive. And I never listened. I never, you know, tried to deviate from my strategy. I said, you know, this is just the strategy that I have, and this is what I'm going to do. I'm never going to try to grow it too big. And I just realized that, you know, I had around 8 to 10 months in a row where my sales were exactly the same, you know, give or take, you know, 1 or 2%. But I wasn't doing anything different. And I don't want to say I was getting bored, because I was never bored with the business, but I kind of realized that I didn't have the back end to grow the business. I was spending a lot of time, you know, kind of doing, you know, minuscule tasks, but I was still so afraid to let anyone in because I had, you know, my view of what was my so-called secret sauce. But it wasn't anything I could trademark or patent or, you know, hire someone and, you know, teach them everything and necessarily then have them go out and do it their own. So, you know, when this offer kind of, you know, came up, I said, you know what, I've done the best I could do on my own. You know, I'm never going to go out of business. But if I really want to be a big name in this business and, you know, be known and, you know, start taking my sales from $200,000 to $300,000 a month to, you know, maybe start selling, you know, millions of dollars a month, I would have to, you know, sell the business and really go learn from someone who was, you know, frankly knew more than I did and had the back end systems to make that happen.
So it sounds to me like they weren't looking to acquire you because of something you had in place. It sounds like they wanted to buy you out so you would go away.
I wouldn't necessarily see that. It was more of an exit of, I had my contract, you know, signed, and, you know, I had my large group of tickets and all my sales history and my data, but my sales history was, you know, I had the history, and I wasn't growing the business, which was the most important thing for me. And, you know, I was still very successful. I was still profitable. I was still running at, you know, really, really good profit margins, but I didn't know how to scale a business. And I think that's what it comes down to. And I think, you know, I found an opportunity with a company who was able to scale a business, and they were able to take the inventory and the contracts and the sales data that I had for maybe, let's say, you know, 15 to 20 tickets per show, and be able to use that data to then take it and add it to the shows that they had.
What would you say goes into being a good ticket broker, and what does your day look like? Give me an idea, like inside from waking up. Are you rolling out of bed and looking at what tickets are going on sale? Do you have the inside word from a promoter that none of us know, so you get first dibs on it? Like, how does that work?
So the very interesting thing is I find out about a tour, you know, usually before it gets announced to the public, but there's nothing I can do about it. So it's, you know, it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of, you know, having information, but the tickets aren't on sale yet, so I can't buy them. And, you know, they don't really give access to, you know, much sales information. So I usually roll out of bed, I'll go online, I subscribe to a couple email lists, and I'll see who's going on sale today or tomorrow, what events just got announced. And then I'll sit down with this company, I'll sit down with our CEO and CFO, and I'll say, okay, you know, based on past results, I think a tour is going to be popular, you know, because of this reason. And then in the next coming days, I'll start gathering all, you know, the information I can find about streams and searches and past performances and what the pricing was on their previous shows. And we'll kind of then say, okay, we have, you know, $100,000, $200,000, $500,000. That's how much money we have to spend on this tour. Where do we think it's best allocated to? Because one thing with ticket sales that I always, you know, tell people who ask me questions is, you know, if you run, you know, a t-shirt company and you make a t-shirt for $5 and you sell a t-shirt for $10, you make $5 per shirt, and however many shirts you sell is your profit. Well, ticketing is not like that, because I can sell $500,000 worth of tickets, but still lose $100,000 because I just might be buying the most expensive tickets and, you know, be selling them for 10% under. I might be buying tickets for $500 and selling them for $400 and saying, wow, I have, you know, $1,600 in sales because I bought 4 tickets, but it really costs me $2,000. So then, you know, we'll try to figure out, based on the amount of money that we have to spend, do we want to buy tickets that are, you know, very expensive, that are close to the stage, that we can mark up for hire? Or, you know, do we want to buy the cheaper tickets and sell more quantity than quality? And that's something that I spend the majority of my time researching, you know, trying to figure out what the median income of the city that we're buying in. What is the median income of the artists that we're buying? Are we buying, you know, Broadway, which, you know, usually appears to the more wealthy? Or are we buying, you know, house music that, you know, is being sold to usually kids? So, you know, maybe it's best to buy in quantity because they want to sit general admission that's close to each other. So there are many different things that I need to look at, you know, again, streams, demographics, median incomes, and all these, you know, different statistics that I usually have a couple of days to look at before a tour. And then when it goes on sale, you know, we're buying tickets online and on the phone, just, you know, until we can't get any more, until it's all sold out.
Are you a very organized person when it comes to spreadsheets and keeping all of your data easily accessible and well organized so you can check back on it constantly?
Not in the slightest. But one thing I learned about starting a business, and I learned this from starting a business and then moving to this business, and a piece of advice that I would give to any entrepreneur is, or just anyone who's in business in general, is figure out where you're the strongest and where your assets are, and then figure out what your biggest liabilities and what your biggest weaknesses are, and hire people who complement your biggest weaknesses. So the first person when I moved to Key Investment Group that I, you know, hired from my team was this woman who, you know, was the most organized person I'd ever met in my life. She came from a military family, you know, very punctual, organized, you know, every report was color coded just the way that I liked it. So I was able to, you know, see where I was weak and be able to hire someone who complimented it. And, you know, from there on out, I've always tried to either hire someone who's completely like me, if I'm looking for, you know, someone in the sales space, or if I'm looking for someone in the organization space, hire someone who's completely opposite of me.
That's very good advice. And not many people think along those lines. Usually they gravitate toward people like them, and you have two people that are bad at something. So it's wise to identify what your strengths are, what your weaknesses are, and team up. What was it like going from being in charge of your own business and running things the way you wanted to now being involved with others? Do you like it better, or do you find more challenges needing to do things not necessarily the way that you would have done it?
So, you know, it's very, very different. The one thing I will say is of my company, our CEO, CFO, and, you know, COO, you know, they're very, very hands-off, and they put the trust in everyone they hired, you know, to kind of come in and do the job that, you know, that they were hired to do. And I pushed that down to, you know, to the people who work under me. I remember at the beginning, though, I found it very difficult because here I am, you know, wanting to buy a lot of tickets for a tour and, you know, kind of being overruled at the beginning at certain points. And, you know, me being like, wow, you know, this is kind of different. And, you know, I've never, in a sense, in the business place, been told what to do before. So now being told, it's definitely different. But another lesson I learned is, when hiring people, you should make sure that everyone you hire is invested in the success of your business. And this company that hired me, the company did better, I did better. And everyone I hired, our part of the business does better, they do better. And, you know, when you have that notion of, if the company does better, I do better, then you really shouldn't have a boss, because everything that you do should be to benefit the company.
What's the future of what it is that you do? How has COVID taken the wind out of your sail? And what have you done to pivot so that you can survive and still offer something to those looking to fill that need of concerts and live events?
So, yeah, I mean, no one saw COVID coming, obviously. And our business got absolutely destroyed by it. I know from February to April, we lost around 98 to 99% of our business gone because there weren't any events taking place. And everyone was, you know, everyone I remember in April was, you know, afraid to leave their house. You thought, you know, you would never go to eat at another restaurant again. You thought the world was, in a sense, coming to an end. And, you know, as a company, you know, what we decided to do was we had primarily just been in the ticket space. And, you know, we said, okay, ticketing is going to come back. It's going to come back stronger than ever, we believe. But how can we use our knowledge and our data to really help the overall entertainment space? How do we become more than just a ticketing company? do we become, you know, do we start, how do we start mixing in sports memorabilia, concert memorabilia? Well, obviously we know what the best teams are and which players generate the most attention. Well, how can we capitalize on that player? Can we buy, you know, signed autographs of different things? Can we buy collectibles? I know the best, you know, musicians coming around. So, you know, can we sign, you know, can we buy memorabilia from, you know, certain shows? And right now, the one that we realize is that when people are staying at home, collectibles of all sorts are becoming, you know, more popular than ever. You know, people are staying home and they want to look at, you know, different collectibles that remind them of when they were able to go to live events. So we pivoted in that space a little bit, and our sales are not nearly, you know, what they were, but we are able to keep the business alive, and now we can start, you know, regrouping for, we can start regrouping for when things come back, because we have other streams of income that we can now capitalize, that when there is a vaccine and when, you know, live entertainment hopefully starts coming back to full scale, which we predict to be, you know, spring of 2021, you know, we'll have these, you know, 3 to 4 different very, very successful avenues of business.
Well, I hope you are right in many respects. If I had to give my guess with predicting business, which what the hell do I know, which nobody really knows, I would say whatever you plan for spring of 2021, it won't go that way. So whatever you plan, it never happens like you plan. And I could do a spinoff podcast on all the things that I thought were going to go one way. And boy, did I guess that one wrong. To me, it's once you learn that valuable lesson with, you said, scaling, with finding additional add-ons that you can sell. And I think all this is going to, you'll be able to apply it to any business that you start. And as a young business person, I think when you love the hustle and you love business, you're going to find that you can apply the same strategies to really anything. And it works. One more question I had that totally off topic. What's the most expensive ticket you've ever sold for a venue? And I'm curious who the performer was.
So the most expensive ticket I ever sold was for sports, it's always the Super Bowl. The Super Bowl is just, you know, it's the must go to event of every year. But the biggest ticket I ever sold was for Country Music Fest in Nashville at Nissan Stadium. I once sold a ticket, 4 tickets for $7,000
each. $7,000
each? Each. It was in the second row and it was a 4-day event and it was wild.
So does someone approach you to first say, I'm looking to go to this event, and then you have to go then look and see if you can even get it. Then you get back to them and feel out how much they're willing to pay. Like, how does that go down?
For events that are much larger scales like this, I do, you know, tap into people I know in the industry. And someone in finance reached out to me and they said, hey, you know, we have fans. They've always wanted to go to this event. They're becoming, you know, a big client of ours. You know, see if you can get tickets. You know, I've looked around. It's not online. Like, see if you can get tickets in the first, you know, 2 or 3 rows if you can. And I was able to reach out to someone and they were, you know, able to give me the tickets. And then I reached out to this person and I said, like, how much are you willing to pay? And they said, you know, these clients are, you know, very, very important to us. Like, whatever it's worth, like, we want to get them in the second row. And, you know, it just so happened. And, you know, I just kind of threw out a number and I just said, you know, $7,500. And then I like thinking they would come down to 5. And they, you know, said, how about 7,000 each? And I, you know, kind of very coyly just said, yeah, very good, very fair offer type thing. And it was nuts.
Well, you said they wanted second row. I'm guessing they wanted first row, preferably.
Preferably.
So you still have that certain amount of street hustler or scalper involved in the process. So it almost seems like you're very analytical to where you sound like a stockbroker or someone like reading the markets, but it can also be a matter of that individual client or person you're buying the tickets for, seeing how much you can get from them, and then become a matter of negotiation. So it really is very reflective of business as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, for things like that, you know, like I wouldn't go like look to, you know, go for a ticket that's under 100. You know, if someone's like, oh, you know, can you get me a ticket for $100? I'd kind of say, you know, just go online type thing. But sometimes, you know, you have to be nervous when, you know, when it's an event of that high profile, I want to make sure I'm seeing the deal through and through. And I would rather take it offline and give it to an actual customer, so I know, because I know someone who's willing to spend that much money is going to be a customer for life type of thing. And you know, there's a little bit, you know, there's a little bit of the personal sales aspect of any business that's, you know, enjoyable, and you know, making connections. And you know, I'm trying to, you know, whatever the next business we go into is, you know, how do I use that person or that client as a connection? Obviously, they're successful enough that, you know, they didn't blink about spending $28,000 for tickets. So, you know, they must be in some type of successful business.
Yeah. And I say all the time with my organization, Connects, it's all about the personal relationships, because that's what it's all about. It's not what you know, it's not who you know, it's who you know that knows what you know. So if I know that you can get tickets to anything, that makes you more valuable, because I can put you in contact with someone looking for, and then that makes me look good as the person bringing you two together. But I love what you're doing. I like that you were so inspired to create your own destiny, your own future at a young age. I love that you're successful with it. I think there'll be many more great things to come as you discover and learn more about business, people, yourself, all the above. So where can people get in contact, find you, hit you up for $28,000 worth of tickets? How do they go about doing that?
For me, the best place to find me is on LinkedIn. That's where I spend most of my time. I get a lot of inspiration, and I find that that's the best way for me to meet people, you know, in any industry, or talk to anyone in business, because, you know, the dialogue is so open. So you can just find me on LinkedIn. My first name, Evan, E-V-A-N, last name, Samet, S-A-M-E-T.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Evan, for your time. Thanks for sharing your story, and I wish you nothing but the best in the future.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me on. This was really enjoyable.
For more info, visit getconnex.com. That's GETCONNEXX.com. Or visit us on Facebook at Connex, INC, or on Instagram at Connex_. And a special thanks to our sponsor, Don Pablo. Boulder Coffee is roasted in small batches, providing the freshest tasting coffee imaginable. Simply put, it's a better cup of coffee. Order on Amazon or at DonPabloCoffee.com.